abandon free market principles to save the free market system.
In a world of conventional confusion,
There will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
Daddy, what do taxes pay for?
Oh, why everything. Policemen, trees, sunshine. And let's not forget the folks who just don't feel like working, God bless them.
Don't be afraid of your freedom.
Prepare to unshackle your mind.
An idea whose time has come cannot be stopped by any army or any government.
Your professor has arrived. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody. It is Friday, January 17th, 2014. Tom Woods here, taking on government propaganda Monday through Friday, noon Eastern at TomWoodsRadio.com. And after that, on iTunes and any other podcatcher you like as a podcast. Make sure and subscribe to the program so you don't miss any episodes like this one with Ben Swan. Think how heartbroken you would be if you missed hearing Ben Swan. You know Ben Swan. We're talking Ben Swan with two N's, BenSwan.com. Ben Swan has spent 14 years working as a journalist in broadcast news as a writer, producer, and TV anchor. In 2010, he moved to Cincinnati, Ohio, where he became the producer of a segment called Reality Check on the local Fox affiliate. And that's where so many of us came to know him, particularly during the most recent Ron Paul presidential campaign. Ben has won two Edward R. Murrow Awards and two Emmy Awards for his investigative journalism. And he joins us today to take your questions and to talk about what he's reporting on these days. Ben, thanks so much for coming back on the program.
Tom, thanks for having me on.
Well, you know, anytime I'm going to have you on, everybody has a million questions they want to ask. So in a few minutes, we'll turn to some listener-supplied questions. But I want to talk to you about things you're reporting on these days, things that are current, things that are going on that people can find out about at BenSwan.com and through your various social media outlets. So let's talk about, I almost hate to bring up the subject of Chris Christie and ruin everybody's day, but it has to be talked about, the ugliness of Chris Christie. And to me, it's kind of great that Chris Christie is coming down a couple notches, because to see him as the front runner for 2016 was just too much. So now we'll get Jeb Bush instead, I suppose. You know, tomato, tomato. But tell us about not so much the traffic issue, but you guys reported way in advance of everybody else, when everybody else was treating it as a non-story, the issue of the federal investigation over the or the whole issue of the Sandy funds and how they were spent and the commercials and everything. Can you fill us in on that?
Yeah, absolutely, because you're right. We were talking about this back in August, even before the feds were investigating it, and
okay,
it was a non-story to a lot of folks because they acted like, well, you know, this is just picking on Chris Christie and leave him alone and he's fine. This is what everyone does, and now all of a sudden it's a legal issue. But here's the backstory. So when the Stronger Than the Storm ad campaign was put together with Sandy relief funds, you know, we reported that Christie's administration had used it like a campaign ad. They put the governor in the ad, they put his family in the ad, and they were running it during a campaign season. Now, the reason that it's now, you know, being investigated by the Inspector General's office is simply this, because $5 million went to this Stronger Than the Storm campaign ad. Now, whenever you have these ads that are out there, you obviously, you know, will put them out to bid, and then different companies will come in and bid on them. There were two companies who bid on doing this ad campaign. One of them came in around $2 million, a little more than that, about $2.5 million or so. And then the other one came in around $5 million, okay? So you have these two competing agencies, one significantly more expensive than the other. So as we reported, though, the Christie administration chooses the much more expensive company to put together this campaign. And when you dig into why, we don't know absolutely why, but here's what we see. We see two things happen. Number one, the company that did get the bid, MWW, actually made far more political contributions than the firm that lost, Sigma Group. Sigma Group hasn't made any political contributions, you know, left or right. MWW usually donates to Democrats, but in this case, they had actually donated to the Christie campaign as well as many of their employees. But secondly, when they went in to sit down and come up with their proposal of how they would do the ad, MWW said, we think that the ads should feature the governor and his family, and they should be front and center in the ads. The Sigma Group said, we think that the ads should be about New Jersey and the recovery and not include the governor. And because the governor was not in them, that company did not get the bid. Now, do I know for sure that that's why they didn't get it? No. But here's what we know. We know that a company that charged almost twice as much in taxpayer dollars agreed to put the governor in the ad, and that's ultimately the company that got the bid.
So the investigation then is going to try to get to the bottom of what the motivation was, presumably, behind hiring the one company over the other. I mean, I don't know how you go to motive on a question like this, but as you say, it seems highly suspicious.
Well, and certainly when you're talking about, you know, you have these taxpayer dollars that are going to the Sandy relief efforts, and, you know, at the end of the day, there was a lot of back and forth about whether or not taxpayers should even be bailing out folks who would suffer damage. You know, isn't this a state issue, not a federal issue? Why are taxpayers federally paying for this? And then, you know, when that money does get to New Jersey, $5 million is spent on TV commercials saying, hey, we did well. Hey, everyone feels good. So, you know, there was controversy to begin with. But when you're talking about such a significant price difference between the two, and really the only difference between them appears to be, again, political connection and the fact that they were willing to put the governor in the ads.
What do you make, by the way, before we get on to any other issues, of the fact that we have been seeing in the polls, at least maybe up till recently, that Christie really has been dominating in a lot of states in terms of thinking ahead? Now, I think, by the way, this is the earliest I've ever seen people being asked about presidential races. I mean, they were being asked all through 2013 whom they favored. But isn't it, what do you make of the fact that he kept showing up at number one or number two in state after state? I mean, haven't we already had Bob Dole, John McCain, Mitt Romney? Is there a problem with the learning curve here?
Well, I think the difference is this between a Bob Dole and a John McCain and a Chris Christie is that Chris Christie has this kind of swagger about himself, where he comes off as a tough guy, and he, you know, doesn't put up with nonsense from anyone, and he'll take on the unions, and a lot of the Republican voters, primary voters, really like that about him. They feel like he's a strong candidate. He's a strong guy. I think the more you look at Chris Christie's background, and we've actually been doing some work on this as well, in terms of his kind of track record, Brit Hume said on Fox News a few days ago that the reason that Christie's getting picked on is because he's so, number one, masculine, and number two, has this muscular attitude that ultimately, you know, has some baggage that comes with it. But that's not why people say he's a bully. If you look at the guy's record, anybody who crosses him, anybody who says something he doesn't like, his administration goes after them. You know, he's gone after Democrats in New Jersey. He's gone after Republicans in New Jersey who have just said little things that were deemed critical. And therefore, he works to get them, you know, to lose their seat through redistricting or to pull finances. And this guy has a pattern of behavior. And if you think that Obama is vindictive against whistleblowers, you think that this Obama administration, which is the worst in U.S. history in terms of going after whistleblowers and leakers, I think that it would be hard-pressed to be able to compete with the Christie administration in that respect.
You know, Ben, I wonder, again, you can't know motive for sure,
right?
But do you think it's a coincidence? I mean, now, I haven't been following the story closely enough, but is it a coincidence that right after this traffic scam gets blown up before the public about, for political reasons, they created traffic in Fort Lee and all that, just around the time that breaks, the federal government announces that it's going to investigate the disbursement of the Sandy funds? Is that a coincidence? Or is that because how did that come about?
That's a good question. The fact of the timing on it seems very interesting. But remember, again, the Sandy relief question started back in August, so it's not a new case. The Inspector General's announcement of the investigation certainly seems like it was timed awfully close to the bridge scandal. Whether or not one was prompted by the other to say, let's go ahead and make this announcement now, I don't know. I really don't know the answer to that. But yeah, I agree with you. The timing seems odd. But again, this is an investigation that really should have been going on for months now.
All right, let's talk Rahm Emanuel now. Let's talk about electronic cigarettes. I have no idea what an electronic cigarette is or what the point of it is or how it works, but apparently people like them. So first of all, just tell us what this thing is. I feel so square, you know, being so unhip, not knowing about this. First, tell us about this, and then tell me what's going on in Chicago with them.
Okay, so an electronic cigarette is called an e-cigarette. Basically, it's a battery-powered device that simulates tobacco smoking. Okay, they vaporize liquid. It contains a little bit of nicotine in it, but mostly they release flavored vapor. And in most cases, it's just flavored vapor. So e-cigarettes are becoming much more popular with Americans who are trying to wean themselves off of, you know, their smoking habit. And there's no scientific evidence at this point that the vapor that's emitted from these e-cigarettes is dangerous. Okay, so basically, there's no proof that there is any secondhand smoke issue with e-cigarettes, none whatsoever. However, in Chicago, that's not enough, because Rahm Emanuel is pushing now for a new rules to say you can be banned from smoking with those electronic cigarettes indoors. They want to force people who use them to stand outside of restaurants and bars and other buildings near other cigarette smokers, okay, because this is the Clean Indoor Air Act. But again, this isn't smoke being emitted from an e-cigarette. It's vapor. It's water, essentially, that's being emitted. And so what you're trying to do is break your habit of smoking, and Chicago wants to make you go stand outside next to the smokers.
What do you think motivates this? I mean, given that this is, of all possible things to focus on, this has got to be dead last on the list of priorities. I can't think of anything other than just the pure thuggery of enjoying making people miserable. I mean, am I being too cynical? Like, what could possibly be behind this? It's obviously not a health concern.
No, it's not a health concern. And yet, as part of this Clean Indoor Air Act that Rahm Emanuel is pushing, as part of that also, all electronic smoking devices have to be sold behind store counters, which they say will make young people less likely to start smoking an e-cigarette. Now, why would a young person start smoking an e-cigarette? If you're going to start smoking, you're going to start the real thing,
right,
not the fake thing. You know, and I think part of it is, I agree with the term thuggery that you used. It's just this mentality that says we have to police every bit of your behavior. It has to be controlled. We can't allow anything to be left up to chance. And so it's just this ongoing case that we have in this country of this nanny state mentality. We have to control what you do and how you do it. And you know, if something, even if it just has the appearance of being something we don't like, we've got to monitor it, restrict it, and control it.
You know, Ben, the irony of this is that every time we catch the slightest glimpse of the personal lives of these people, we find out that they are involved up to their necks in every imaginable vice. You know, and these are the ones who are going to lecture us on how to lead our lives.
Well, exactly, because, you know, it really comes back to this mentality, and you're going to have to forgive me for using the phrase, because I need to use it correctly here, but it is a fascist mentality. And when you use the term fascism, now hear me out, because this term gets misused all the time. George Orwell said very well at one point that the term fascism is utterly meaningless, because essentially people substitute the word for bully. But real fascism is this belief that there is a corporate and there is the individual, and the individual never trumps the rights of the corporate, meaning the collective. And yet someone has to rule the collective. And so that's what we've created in our modern America, is this American fascism that says individuals have no rights, the collective has rights, but when the collective has rights and the individual doesn't, guess what? The collective doesn't have rights. They merely are used to enforce whatever whim dear leader decides to impose upon us. And so I agree with you. You have all these folks who claim to be looking out for the best interest of the public, and in their own personal lives, they live however they want. But they want to be able to dictate to you what you'll eat, when you'll eat, what you'll smoke, if you won't smoke, where you'll stand, where you'll sleep, everything.
Ben, I want to do a little maybe sort of greatest hits things with you, because some of the listeners of the program follow you very closely as well. And, you know, it's kind of like, gosh, I can't remember, Brian Regan, maybe, the stand-up comedian. My wife and I went to see him, and at the end of his act, he takes requests from the audience, and he can't understand why people would make requests of a stand-up comic. You've heard the material before, so why are you requesting it? But people, though, are interested in some of the work that you've done also in the past. So somebody raised with me that you've done some work connecting the U.S. government with some drug cartel. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, and there's actually quite a bit of evidence of this. The drug cartel situation in Mexico is kind of interesting because when you look at a map, you can break up Mexico, at least you used to be able to break up Mexico, the way that you would break up the United States with states, where you would break that up with cartel territories. So you have about five or six different cartels that were geographically positioned throughout the country of Mexico. And in 2006, when Felipe Calderón became president of Mexico, what you saw was this push by Calderón to win the drug war and to push the cartels out of Mexico. And what actually happened was that the military began to go into different communities and different cities and declare this war against cartels, but they would only fight one side in each of these cities. So there was a drug war taking place between the resident cartel and then another cartel called the Sinaloa cartel. And then the military would come in to fight as well, but they would never fight Sinaloa. And so what you found was throughout Mexico, and I did a lot of reporting on this back in 2008, 2009, what you were seeing all throughout Mexico was this push by military to get rid of any rival cartels to Sinaloa. That's what was actually happening down there. Well, a few years ago, I think it was in 2011, maybe, there was a case in Chicago, in fact, where a high-ranking official with the Sinaloa cartel was on trial, and he actually began making accusations through that trial that it was actually the U.S. government that was pushing this idea of supporting the Sinaloa cartel over the other ones in order to create one super cartel through which they could, quote-unquote, win the drug war or control the drug supply flowing into the United States. There's a lot of evidence, again, on the Mexican side that the Mexican government was also supporting Sinaloa. So, yeah, there's evidence. There's no smoking gun per se where you can say, okay, we can definitely prove this. But there is a lot of evidence out there that our government and the Mexican government was working with the Sinaloa cartel to try to create a super cartel in Mexico.
Well, again, of course, as you say, if you can't necessarily prove this and that, but my view is that if we, given what we do know about things that government does, one thing we know for sure is they wouldn't be held back by moral considerations from doing these things. Right? I mean, that we can know for sure. If they're not doing it, it's not because they've reflected on it or they've flipped through an ethics book or whatever. It would only be because pragmatically they don't think they can get away with it, would be my view. Now, people are kind of curious to know, how do you measure? Is there some metric by which you can measure how the work you're doing as an independent journalist is cracking through beyond the sort of Ron Paul libertarian sort of circles? Now, even if you're just reporting to those circles, you're doing a tremendous service because then we can take what you've done and run with it and spread it around ourselves.
Well, I think here's the thing. Is there a metric for it? I don't think there's one yet. I think what we're starting to see is that there is a shift right now, and I know this for a fact, among a lot of the networks who are trying to figure out how to reach this audience. And I've had some conversations with some of those networks who are saying, you know, how do we connect with these viewers? The problem is they don't want to necessarily do what it takes to connect with them because they still want to control the message and the outcome and would prefer that you weren't paying attention, but you are. And so I would say for us, you know, there isn't a metric yet, but we're really working to break through that because what we're finding is there are different ways for us to get our content to the mass market. And that's what we're developing right now. And hopefully within the next few weeks and months, that will become much more clear that the content that we're putting out is having an effect because it's reaching more people through mainstream channels. And as that happens, I think what you'll see is more networks and more news content trying to emulate what we've been doing.
If we're dealing with people who are new to what you do, can you explain to people just quickly what kind of content are you putting out, on what sorts of topics, and how often are you putting it out?
Well, what we're trying to do is really break through what we call the left-right paradigm, which is a false paradigm in media. And the idea is to approach stories, talking about them from the perspective, excuse me, of liberty, and the idea that the individual has rights and that media, as the fourth estate, has a responsibility to stand up for those rights, especially against government or corporate encroachment. And so that's what we really tried to do, is focus on stories that deal with your rights as an individual, the rights of the citizenry, and what it means for you to take back authority within whatever sphere you're operating in. That may be your local community, that may be your state, it may be within your own household. And so we're really trying to push that forward. And one of the tactics that we use, we're doing a couple of different things. So we have different forms of media that we're putting out. We're putting out radio vignettes now. We're putting out short form videos that are, you know, 2 minutes to 3 minutes long. And then we've got longer pieces that we have a Roku channel for called the Truth in Media Project. And those episodes, which we just finished up our first season of, will hopefully be on Hulu very soon. And that content, really what we're trying to do is focus on bigger picture stories that media really just hasn't covered.
Now, is your Truth in Media Project and BenSwan.com, is this all Ben Swan, or have you got other contributors?
Right now, it's just me. We have writers on BenSwan.com who are writing articles. So they produce the majority of the written text articles there, and then I produce the majority of the videos.
Now, I've had a couple people ask this kind of question, that when you look on the spectrum of independent journalism, there's a, you know, Alex Jones occupies one end of it. And there are people who say, we love Ben Swan because he sticks to the facts, and yet he nails you right between the eyes. Like, you can't deny what it is that he's saying, and we don't want him to become too sensationalistic. So what do you say to people like that? I want to give you the chance to respond to something like that.
Sure, absolutely. Look, I think the question is, what is sensationalism? I too want to stay away from sensationalism, but sometimes there are stories that have to be covered. And there are people who don't like that idea. They'll say, oh man, you know, don't even talk about these issues because, you know, they're not stories that we think give credibility to this movement, this liberty movement. So I'll give you two examples. One is, we did a piece about 9/11 and the Rethink 9/11 campaign. And there were a lot of people, Tom, who were upset that we did that and said, you shouldn't have talked about this issue because, you know, it just doesn't deserve this kind of attention because it makes you look crazy. Well, listen, the bottom line is, there are a lot of facts that deal with building World Trade Center 7, excuse me, the third building that fell down on 9/11. There are a lot of questions that remain about that. And by the way, you know, the stuff that we talked about in that goes back to a lot of evidence that was false in the NIST report, when NIST put together their report. So that's one thing we were trying to expose. If I had to do it over again, I'd still do that story again, because even though there were people who didn't like it, I think it was the intellectually honest thing to do. Not avoid a story because it carries baggage. And 9/11 stories do carry baggage, but it's still the right story to do. Another one is, we did a piece on vaccine court in America. And a lot of people were freaking out because, oh my gosh, Ben Swan's now going around saying that vaccines cause autism. Go and watch the story. We never say that vaccines cause autism. What we do say is that there are multiple cases where HHS, through vaccine courts, has compensated families for vaccine injury when those families have children who have autism. But they do it quietly and secretly. And we have this whole situation of vaccine court, which is an absolute ridiculous system by which families are to be compensated. When we put that story together, there were people who freaked out. But I'll tell you, the other part of the story that we never got to share because it got canceled is that Congress, under Daryl Issa, is supposed to be investigating vaccine court. He's trying to call hearings. Even now, he's trying to put together a process to have hearings about how abusive vaccine court has become to families who have children who were injured by vaccines. And that's part of, he's running into all kinds of walls with that, because there are people who don't want that hearing to ever take place. So there's a lot going on that I think, you know, you have to cover stories that are intellectually honest. We try to do it in the most professional way possible, but also recognizing as we do it that sometimes people are they're not going to like it because, they're uncomfortable with the subject matter. We're not here to make people comfortable. We are here to draw attention to stories that other media won't. And vaccine court's a great example of a story that other media will not even touch.
Well, I'll tell you, I think you are very effectively staking out a niche for yourself. And it's very hard to do that when you portray yourself as transcending left and right, because usually the way you build up a niche is you identify yourself as being a particular type of person. If you want to get the conservative slant, you go to this person. The libertarian slant, you go to this person. Like, for example, I had a book in 2008 called Who Killed the Constitution? And we pitched this book as being beyond left and right. We're going to show both the left and the right are to blame. And this book bombed. Like, it was like my worst-selling book of all time. People want the book that conservatives are supposed to read or the book that libertarians are supposed to read. It's very hard to say, look, this is just something you should read. And yet somehow you're able to do that. Now, tell me one last thing. Where do you see journalism, let's say, 10 or 20 years from now? Are there going to be more Ben Swans out there, not necessarily doing your type of content, but living a lifestyle like you're living, where you're basically just saying to the public, if you think what I'm doing is valuable, then pitch in?
I hope so. I really do. I hope that we see more of that. I hope that we see more journalists move in that direction. I can't tell you, Tom, how many times since we started this project, but we have had people who have either emailed me or have called me, and who are journalists around the country, news photographers, executive producers, investigative producers, who will say, I wish I could do what you're doing. And I just want to let you know that I think it's great that you're doing it, and I wish I could. But I'm not going to take that risk. That's what most of them finish it with. I'm not going to take that risk. But I hope there will be. And I think through the advent of the internet, certainly through the advent of crowdsourcing, which is still a fairly new concept, it's possible to do that. And, you know, we're actually gearing up to do another round of crowdsourcing for our second season. And we're going to go into some very interesting subjects on this one, and some that people, again, may be shocked by it. And that's okay. What we want to do is we really want to chase after truth. And it's hard to do when you're crowdsourced. I tell you, Vice is a great example of where you get a very wealthy guy who's put together, you know, Vice TV, and they're doing really interesting content. But when you launch it on your own, when you're not a wealthy guy trying to do that, it's a much harder process. So I'm incredibly grateful to all the folks out there who have supported what we've done and who continue to do so.
Well, I hope people will check out your work. I mean, you've got 8 gazillion likes on Facebook, which is great. I assume it's facebook.com/BenSwan with 2 N's, and then you've got BenSwan.com. Am I right about your Facebook page?
Yeah, it's actually Ben Swan Reality Check, but if you just type in Ben Swan, it'll pop up.
Nice. Good. All right, Ben, thanks again for being here. You're generous with your time, and we had to move around the time of this thing, and you're a super good sport, so I appreciate it. Best of luck with everything.
Tom, thank you so much.
All right, that's the program for today. Just want you guys to know I am assembling transcripts of all the interviews that we did on this program in 2013. I'm going to assemble them into an ebook, and I'm going to give it away to everybody for free. So if you want to know how to get hold of that, make sure and become a subscriber of this program, which of course is free, over on iTunes or wherever else you like to get podcasts. Go on over and subscribe to the program, and once that ebook is ready, I'll be talking about it constantly, and you listeners will know how to grab it for yourselves. All right, next week, we got Scott Horton of The Scott Horton Show. We got Walter Williams, unbelievable. We got Jacob Hornberger of the Future of Freedom Foundation, and more. And remember, you can help us pay our bills at no cost to yourself. When you're about to make a purchase on Amazon, make that purchase through our Amazon widget at TomWoodsRadio.com, and I will be super grateful. All right, everybody, enjoy your weekend. See you next week.
The Tom Woods Show.